Today's date is Tuesday, September 15, 2009. My name is Jonathan Gerland, and I'm with Ray Palsy at the History Center. And today I'm interviewing him, and we're going to talk about a few things, but I guess primarily the Dieball Municipal Golf Course. And maybe we can just begin, Mr. Palsy. What brought you to Dieball?
Well, back in the 60s, I came to Lufkin to train for the Postal Inspection Service at the Lufkin Post Office. And I'd been a golfer most of my life. I was raised around a golf course. And
where was that?
That was in Downers Grove, Illinois.
Okay.
And so, like I said, I was quite familiar. I had come to Lufkin from Athens, where I had been in law enforcement. And a friend of mine that was with the Postal Inspection Service wanted me to come to Lufkin and train to be with the Postal Inspection Service, which I did. And that was in the early 60s. It must have been around 1964 or 5. And while I was at the post office, I started playing golf at what used to be the Oak Ridge Golf Course in Lufkin. It was out 103 East. About a couple miles from the paper mill, and it was built by J. Laverne Green, who was a paper mill employee. Him and some guys decided they'd build a golf course out there for paper mill employees of the Southland Paper Mill. And it was a public golf course, and it was run by his son at the time, and his wife and family, and they lived out there in a house, and the front part of the house was the pro shop, but it was a 9-hole golf course, didn't have any irrigation or anything. And so I started playing out there, and that was the only place that most people had to play in that was a public course, was out there at Oak Ridge Golf Course. And I lived in Lufkin at that time. So I'd met a fellow by the name of Spencer Knutson, who was with Temple at that time. He was in the forestry division, and I played golf with him. And he was telling me in 1967 about a golf course they were going to build down here in Dieball. And I lived right across the street from him at that time, and he asked if I had any interest in it, because I did. I'd golfed for a long time, and I said, shoot, yeah. I said, I'm fixing to have to go to Washington, D.C., and I've already been up there, and I don't like it. I said, if I can find something around here that's suitable, I would certainly be interested.
With your job, you were going to be
chancellor? With my job, yes. Yeah. I had been with the Postal Service, and wasn't too excited about Washington, D.C., and I was fixing to have to be transferred up there, and so I said, well, I would certainly come down here and interview for the job, which I did.
And what was the job title?
The job was they were looking for a general, at that time they were looking for somebody just to generally help with the construction of the golf course. The golf course had already been under construction. The weather had been just terrible in 1967 and 68, and they just did not get very far with it. In fact, of the matter is, Montgomery Paving Company out of Harlingen, Texas, were the contractors that were moving the dirt, and Mr. Montgomery got killed in a plane crash coming from Wolf City, where he had a golf course, going down here. And he got killed, and his son had taken over the business. His name was Dick Montgomery, young man. And so anyway, that's how it all, the land actually stood idle probably for 6 months or more because of the death of the original contractor, Richard Montgomery. Like I say, the weather was just terrible. It had been rain, and they couldn't do any work, and there just wasn't really a whole lot done, except for the timber had been cleared. Leon Howard and his brother out of Austin, they were the architects, and they laid it out. In fact, I think I probably somewhere still have the original plans. If I can dig them up, I'll bring them to you.
Sure, great.
Because I think I still have all of the original plans on how it was laid out.
Was it laid out from the beginning as nine holes?
Yes, it was as a nine-hole course. In fact, of the matter is, where the ADCO is now was going to be a quarter horse track. That used to be the old airstrip. That area all down through there used to be the old airstrip. H.G. Stubblefield was one of the pilots, and he used to bring in, they used to have a Piper, I forget what size it was, that they'd bring in and land there on the old airstrip. And he was one of the pilots at that time. But anyway, and that's, like I said, it was a whole complex of things that were going to be developed originally with the golf course. And one of them was a quarter horse racetrack. I've got all those plans that show all of that, the layout for that and stuff like that. So I'll dig them up, Jonathan, and and bring them to you. But anyway, so Spencer Knutson suggested that I come down here, and he would get with Mr. Stubblefield, who headed up the Parks Board at that time.
And that's Horace Stubblefield.
That's Horace Stubblefield, the head Sabine Investment Company, and his wife was a teacher here at the school, Beth. So they set up an interview for me, and I had a lot of friends that were with Temple that had put in good words for me. And
who did you interview with?
I interviewed with Buddy Temple and Horace Stubblefield, and I'm not all sure who all was involved in that. The interview was at the Pine Bough, the old Pine Bough restaurant back in the dining room. I'm not sure if Mr. Temple was there or not, but anyway, to make a long story short, I interviewed. And in a very short period of time, they gave me a call and asked me, well, if the job is yours, and the pay was $400 a month, and I said, well, that'd be fine, no problem, whatever. It's a little less than I'm making. So I went out there and started working, and this was before there was any building or anything like that. Mr. Temple told me to go up to the Chevrolet place and get you a pickup truck, get you a used pickup truck up there. So I went up there and got an old 64-5 model Chevrolet pickup truck. And that was my vehicle, and I hauled all my junk around in it for the golf course. So
Now your paycheck, was the city of Diboll?
City of Diboll.
Okay.
City of Diboll.
So you were a city?
I was a city employee.
Okay.
I was definitely a city employee. Okay. And so anyway, in a very short period of time, Marvin Baker was hired to build a pro shop out there, and that is down on what is Arrington Drive, I guess is the name of it, is where the original pro shop and parking lot and things like that were. And that was all constructed in 69 and 70 because we opened the golf course in, I think, August of 1970, if I'm not mistaken. Looking at this sign-in sheet,
yeah.
I think the first sign-in sheet was in August, 8/29/70.
August 29th of 70.
Is when we opened it. And so, like I say, but my job consisted of a lot of just grunt work.
So the plans had already been drawn out, and by plans I mean...
Oh, they had blueprints and everything.
The lay of the course.
Everything had been laid out.
So you were supervisor of
everything,
the project.
General project supervisor, that's correct. And so anyway, I got with Mr. Richard Montgomery's son, who was Dickie Montgomery and those people, and I worked very closely with them on the construction. In fact, I drove a maintainer and bulldozer and just everything it took to do that. And then we got a firm out of Irving, Texas called Venable Irrigation, and they laid out, they did the irrigation work. And I worked very closely with them on all phases of the construction, including the irrigation work and things like that. I just was hands-on on all of that. Every bit of it was a hands-on. Like I said, I even drove a maintainer and bulldozer, front-end loader, whatever it took to get the job done.
Did you have any time to play golf while all this was
There was
going
no
on?
Golf going on at that time.
Well,
no.
I know
anywhere.
Course,
I didn't play
didn't
much of anywhere because
right.
It was a 24/7 job, really, is what it amounted to. Particularly after we got the irrigation system in and got all the fairways leveled and the greens built and constructed. We had a big pile of what we call seed bed material piled up there along what is now Arrington Drive that we had mixed and made and had brought in. We had a mountain of it there to build the greens with. And so anyway, shortly after we got the irrigation system in, the pipeline people said they were going to lay a new pipeline across what was at that time the old number 5 green. And they said, I said, well, you know, we've got a watering system in there. They said, well, we're just going to cut on through everything and we'll pay for the repair. You know, it was easier for them rather than trying to dig around that stuff. So they came in with all their equipment and went, the pipeline is still there naturally, but they cut right on through all of our watering system and everything else with the total disregard for anything and said, just send us the bill. We'll pay for the repairs.
Now, was that before the course opened? Or?
Oh, yeah, way before. Okay. Before even there was any grass finished yet. A lot of it had been planted, but nothing was there. So
so I guess that contributed to the delay. I know in the newspapers,
definitely.
I think y'all were shooting for July 4th.
Yeah.
Of 70 and
yeah.
Delayed it.
Yeah, that certainly contributed to the delay. We wanted to get the seed wasn't planted till in July, and we had seed bed material. We had sprigs for our greens that was a hybrid Bermuda called TIFF 427 is what the sprigs were, and they came from Tyler. The district attorney up there in Smith County was Hunter Brush, and he also had a sod farm up there on I-20, and even there's a golf course up there by his place. Garden Valley is what it is up there on I-20, but that was Hunter Brush's, and he sold us the sprigs in that of this hybrid Bermuda. They had them, and so we sprigged the greens and tee boxes with TIFF 427, and in no time at all they came up, and all we had was hand mowers. We didn't have any I think we had bought 2 used hand mowers to mow the greens and tees with at that time. And we had, the greens were huge. They were absolutely huge, and so were the tee boxes. But that was a trade of these, Leon Howard and them. They designed big greens and big tee boxes. And over the years, certainly they've shrunk considerably, but
what about sand traps? Were they in there?
All right. The sand traps were not. That was an afterthought of Mr. Temple's. Mr. Temple came out, and Mr. Temple and I were very, very close. I got with him every day during the construction. I got with him every day. I got with Horace Stubblefield every day. And I would go over to Mr. Temple's office, and we would sit and talk and see how things were going and things like that. But we had a daily meeting, and Mr. Temple was very much hands-on as far as involved in the golf course and wanting to get it done. And the sand traps were an afterthought.
Didn't come until 73.
Right. Almost 3 years after we'd opened the course.
Any reason why they were an afterthought? Why they weren't?
He just thought it would make the golf course look better and things like that. So he brought.
But I mean, any indication why they weren't?
They were never in the design of the golf course. In Leon Howard's design, there was no sand traps involved. Period. It was just. You have to remember, this was back then, East Texas golf courses didn't have sand traps,
okay.
None of them. I mean, all of them were in fact, this was probably going to be the first golf course in East Texas with greens that were constructed the way greens should be constructed, elevated and not just cut out of the flat land that the golf course was built on. The older East Texas golf courses, you know, were just built on where they'd clear some land and put where they wanted greens and things like that. So this was actually the first one that had tee boxes that were constructed with the proper material, and also greens that were constructed with seedbed material and drainage and things like that built into them. So no sand traps were involved in it. And there were several reasons for that. One was the where you could get more play. Yeah, it would keep play moving smoother and things like that without sand traps and things like that. You know, there wouldn't be delays of people getting in the sand traps and having to rake them and things like that, and maintenance-wise and things like that. When we decided that we were going to put in sand traps, we had to understand that the cost of maintaining a sand trap is almost the same as the cost of maintaining a green. It's a very expensive procedure. You have to build drains in them, and you have to go out where the drains are going to be, and then you have to have maintenance of the sand traps. Even more so than the greens. It's more expensive to maintain a sand trap properly with the trimming and edging and keeping them raked and things like that. So that had that the economics of it also contributed to the fact that we didn't have sand traps. But Mr. Temple decided we were going to have sand traps, and so he brought down,
Jimmy DeMeritt?
Jimmy DeMeritt. From Champions Golf Course in Houston. They came out here, and Jimmy and myself and Mr. Temple, we went around with a can of spray paint and painted where the traps were going to be with white spray paint, all of that. So we had all the traps laid out, and Mr. Temple laid out a bunch of little, what they call spot traps, just for decorative purposes and, you know, for no other reason than that. But I could see that that was going to be a real maintenance project. So a lot of those traps never got put in. And that did not make Mr. Temple very happy. In fact, the matter is, we had several meetings over that, and I told him I had to maintain them, and, you know, we didn't have, economically, I explained to him that I had to do away with several of his little spot traps that he had. Well, I never did convince him of that, but the course got built with, the traps got put in without those little, a lot of the spot traps. But there were some really neat sand traps on what used to be a par 3 hole, which is now the part of the finishing hole there, number 17 now out at the new golf course, but it was hole number 2. At that time it followed a par 5, which was hole number 1 over the pond. We had a sand trap there to the right side of the green that had an island in the middle of it. And it was really, really a neat sand trap. It was very unique. It was a big sand trap and had a grass island in the middle of it. In fact, a lot of golfers would, not by design, but would land up on top of that island and play their next shot off of that little island in the middle of the trap, you know, onto the green. So it was kind of neat. There were a lot of neat greens. A lot of neat sand traps that Jimmy DeMeritt laid out. In fact, the matter is, I saw some old pictures of Jimmy DeMeritt and Mr. Temple and myself out there laying them out. Paul Durham came out and took a lot of pictures while we were in the process of laying out the sand traps. But we got the sand traps laid out, and that was another problem because our irrigation system was already in. We really had some problems. We cut a lot of irrigation lines, and there were a lot of delays because of that.
But you mentioned hole 2. I didn't play golf a whole lot, but I played for about a year or 2 years in college, and of course that was when it was a 9 hole.
Uh-huh.
And I remember number 2, you were talking about elevated greens. And,
right.
As I recall, the back side of that thing was pretty steep.
Yeah.
And I do remember those sand traps around there.
But the matter is, that golf course, after we were completed with it, and it had been opened, and say in about 1971 or so, that was recognized as probably one of the finest 9-hole golf courses in the state of Texas. We had the University of Houston golf team up here to play in tournaments with Keith Fergus, and a lot of the golfers that you used to see on the Pro Tour came and played at this golf course. And University of Texas, in fact, the matter is, the coach of the University of Houston team called me once. We were having a tournament out there, and we really had some neat tournaments. We were co-sponsored by the Holiday Inn when it used to be in Lufkin, and we'd have an evening up there before the day before the tournament, and have Calcutta and things like that. But anyway, we also were known for the prizes that we gave. We gave tremendous prizes. Well, the University of Houston golf coach, their whole team was coming up to play in our golf tournament. Well, he called me, and he told me he didn't like what we were doing, that we were, you know, he was afraid his players were going to get in trouble with the NCAA because of the prizes we were giving. They were limited to what they could take, and I assured him that we would stay well within the bounds of the NCAA rules and regulations, and wouldn't have any of his people involved in anything that would get them into any trouble. So he eventually gave us his blessing and let his team come up here and play in our tournament. So we had a lot of players from a lot of teams, Lamar Tech and in Beaumont.
So these weren't necessarily NCAA events.
Oh, these were regular amateur tournaments.
Okay.
These were amateur that were flighted and had championship through the fifth flight and things like that. No, they were but there were rules and regulations on how much NCAA player could contribute to. Right. If it was a team event that involved amateurs and things like that, how they could be used and things like that, and the amount of money in prizes that they could receive and things like that to keep them as amateurs.
Right.
And be able to play in NCAA. So we had a lot of big tournaments out there. And like I say, the golf course itself was renowned for being one of the very best nine-hole golf courses in the state. And we had people come from all over to play there. So,
comment a little bit on, you've mentioned Mr. Temple, Arthur Temple Jr. Comment on his interest in this golf course.
Him and Lottie and Bubba Shands and Ann Shands, they would play out there several times a week. Mr. Temple was very hands-on, and so was Lottie. Lottie was very hands-on. In fact, the matter is, we had a hole that was hole number 4 that went across, coming back towards the clubhouse, went over a pond.
I remember
well,
that.
Well, Lottie said, no way that a lady can hit from over there. She said, I want a tee built on the other side of the pond for the ladies. So, Joe Bob Hendricks, we came out the next day, and he said, Mr. Temple sent me out here. He wants me to build a tee box on this side of the lake for Lottie and the ladies to hit from. And so it was just a matter of days that that tee box was constructed and finished and sodded to where they could play on it. So
I was tempted to use that tee box.
Yeah. But they were very... Mr. Temple and his bunch would play out there, like I said, several times a week. They would play out there, and particularly, like I say, Bubba Shands and Arthur, and there were a lot of them that played that used to play at the Lufkin Country Club that would come down here and play because of the course. It was in such good condition and was such a nice place to play. So. But like I say, he was very hands-on, and Mr. Stubblefield was very hands-on, as he was in any project that he was involved in. Like I said, we had daily meetings, we had some confrontations, we had some close calls on me not being here any longer and things like that. And one thing that Mr. Stubblefield probably brought to my attention that has helped me through my life, in a lot of things that I do, he told me, he said, Ray, he said, you've got a lot of projects going, but none of them are finished. He says, he called me, and in fact, they had a park board meeting, and he called me in with Woody Ingram and Joe Elliott and some of the other park board members, and they were actually going to terminate me because I had so much junk going and nothing finished. So he told me, he said, you've got a lot of projects going. He says, you need to finish some of them, you know. He says, don't start other projects till you finish what you've got. So he taught me a very good lesson in life to finish rather than having a bunch of things going, have finished projects and then move on to the next project. So in that respect, Mr. Stubblefield helped me. Like I said, we had a lot of confrontation, but also we were very good friends. We lived across the street from each other here in Diboll on Booker Street. And I saw, you know, I was around when his family grew up, and Gandy and those, you know, and Suzanne. We, you know, like I said, so I became very close with Mr. Stubblefield, even though, like I said, we did have some wars.
Now, I think the newspaper referred to you as the golf pro, the professional.
I was. In fact, the matters I brought with me, I was a Class A PGA professional. I went through all of their schools. I went through all of their qualifying and things like that. I brought all that stuff with me. I didn't bring it in. The only thing I brought in was this. But after the interview, I'll be glad to bring those in and show them to you and give them to you.
Okay.
And you can have them. But they're my certificate from the Professional Golf Association of America, where I am a PGA, a Class A PGA professional, which is the top that you can get in the PGA. And I went through all of their business schools. And like I said, at that time.
Now, this was before you came to Diboll?
No.
Or during?
During the time. In fact, the matter is, I had a lot of things going during the time, and that was another thing that me and Mr. Stubblefield used to get to about. I was taking flying lessons at that time to become a pilot, and I was also going to Stephen F. Austin State University. In fact, I graduated in my undergraduate work was in, I graduated in 1971. So you can see there that I was doing something besides working on the golf course,
right.
Since of my undergraduate degree in business, and then I went to graduate school after that. And but like I said, I got my undergraduate degree in 1971, and so I had quite a few things going other than the golf course. Obviously, I was a very busy individual, and Mr. Stubblefield would chastise me on that. I had so many things going, you know, other than just the golf course, and he told me I needed to put some of them on the back burner, and he said, concentrate more on the golf course. Because at that time, in 1971, see, now when the golf course was originally built, there weren't any cart paths. You know, you just went wherever you could, there, you know, with your golf cart. So probably in about 1971, we started building cart paths out there. And I can remember one particular meeting we had when the golf carts were finished, and Mr. Stubblefield wasn't too happy because I hadn't filled in with dirt around the edges, and I had all these other projects going, flying lessons and school and all those things. So he told me, and, you know, he said I needed to concentrate more on the golf course, which I did. So that I did have a lot of things going.
Who was the city manager during that time?
I don't remember. I know they had several city managers in and out of there, James Dover and some of the other city managers, and I don't remember exactly who was the city manager at that time. In fact, the matter is, most of my dealings, because of the fact that the city manager and some of those other people really weren't familiar with the golf course, were most of all of my dealings were with the park board rather than any city. Yes,
and Mr. Temple.
So I had very little relationship with any city administration.
Right.
So I, even though I was a city employee, I did not have any, didn't report to them in any way at all. I reported to the Parks Board.
So your budget, you pretty much submitted your budget.
I submitted my budget. That's correct.
They took
and
it
that's
from there.
Absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And requests for any equipment. At that particular time, I was very fortunate in that Mr. Temple was heavily involved because he really spoiled me. He told me, you know, I could get whatever I needed, you know, and he said, you get it and let me worry about it. So We had the latest, most up-to-date equipment at that time. In fact, of the matter is, we were probably the first golf course in the area to have a riding greens mower and sand trap rakes and things like that that were all automated. Nobody else had any of that stuff, but we had it. We had the best equipment for spraying and herbicides and fertilizer and things like that. We had two rail cars of lime that we brought in when we were first constructing the golf course, 180 tons of lime that we put on this golf course because they'd been under pine trees for so long. The soil was very acidic, and we needed to get it neutralized, so they brought in two big rail cars full of lime in bulk, and they would take the trucks over there, and they had loaders that would load the trucks and bring them back and spread the lime on the soil before we planted any seed. It was just, like I said, we had the best of everything, really, and that's why we had such a good golf course. We weren't restricted. Our budget was, I was very free to get anything that I could justify needing. Probably the most trouble I ever got into out there was over, I put out some herbicide too early in the year on the greens and knocked back, well, actually just about killed every green. In fact, we had to close the permanent greens. I have a brother that's in California that was familiar with agriculture, and I called him and told him what I had done. And he told me, he says, get powdered charcoal and spray it on those greens right now. So I got down to Houston, got a hold of the chemical people. It was Goldwaite's Chemical Company down there, and told them what I needed. And they got me up here a truckload of powdered charcoal in bags that we mixed with water and sprayed on all of our greens to try to neutralize the herbicide that I had put on there too early in the year. It wasn't that it shouldn't have been applied, but it's just bad timing. It was way too early. It wasn't warm enough. The grass hadn't started up and things like that. So consequently, it killed and knocked back all the greens. So we had to close every one of our greens and build a temporary greens in front of them or to the side of them or something like that. We sprayed those greens with a mixture of water and powdered charcoal, and they were just as black as the earth. It was just unbelievable. And people would come in there just covered with powdered charcoal on their hands from picking up their golf balls that was on the greens that we had sprayed.
What did Mr. Stubblefield and Mr. Temple think about that?
They were very upset, to say the very least. Very, very, very upset. And that was, like I said, I've had several close calls.
Was that early on?
Oh, yeah. It was within the first few years. Like I said, I had a lot of close calls.
No more green seeds, but black seeds.
That's just exactly what it was, for sure, because it was a mess. I had really learned very. In fact, when you're utilizing chemicals, you have to. That's why they train you to use them. You know, I'd go to schools and things like that on a proper application of herbicides or insecticides or fungicides and things like that. So I did learn, but it was costly, to say the least, at some times because I misapplied them and things like that. But I did learn. But
comment a little bit on your staff that you had. Well, once the course, I guess, got up and going. And
I had two people. And myself. We would maintain it, the nine-hole course.
These were full-time city employees?
They were full-time city employees. Yes,
employed at the golf course.
Just for the golf course. Just for the golf. I was ahead of the parks department.
Ahead of the parks.
In fact, the matter is, all of those dome top posts and things like that, we put all those around in the park and things like that. So, like I said, they were golf course employees, but they were city employees that were working full-time at the golf course. I hired them and trained them and did like that. And I've had, we went through quite a few of them at that time because it was quite an ordeal. It was quite a lot of work. In fact, a lot of times, we didn't used to have an automatic sprinkler system. The only automatic sprinklers were on the greens and tee boxes. And when we were first planted that golf course, I had to be out there 24 hours a day, actually, to water at night and things like that to get the grass up. And you had to plug in these sprinklers and turn them and things like that. There was nothing automatic about it. They were all, every sprinkler was manual on all the fairways. There was no such thing as an automatic system out there. They didn't go in with an automatic system for several years after the golf course was constructed. It was the only automatic watering was on the greens and tee boxes. The rest of it was all manual plug-in sprinklers. So on many a night I was out there in the mud and stuff looking for sprinkler heads and things like that. So it brings back a lot of not necessarily happy memories, but a lot of memories. Yeah, but eventually we did get a full automatic watering system. And the people that originally put in our system came down and put in our automatic system also.
Okay. Comment a little bit on, you had mentioned some of the tournaments earlier. I know the newspaper talked a lot about the Labor Day weekend.
Labor Day was a major tournament. That was a three-day tournament. And we used to, it's kind of funny, we used to book it solid. We turned lots and lots and lots of people away on our Labor Day tournament. It was a partnership tournament. Three-day tournament, and it was a very big tournament in East Texas. It was similar to the Temple Cup at Crown that they have now.
So people from all over came.
Oh, came from all over. Arkansas, Louisiana, they came from all over to play in that tournament. A lot from Dallas and things like that.
Now, who was the sponsor of these tournaments?
Well, Holiday Inn helped us, Buddy Temple, and, you know, we just had a lot of, we got out and hustled stuff up. All of the Spalding, I was on the Spalding staff at that time, so I was able to get a lot of stuff from them because, like I said, being a PGA professional, I was sponsored by Spalding. And, in fact, I've even got my old Spalding golf staff bag in my workshop out there. But like I said, Spalding helped us and things like that. But the sponsors, like I say, varied. We would get out and just everybody would get out and work. We had quite a few golfers that would get out, you know, that were local people, Joe Sample and some of these other people that, you know, would get out and hustle up business for you. In fact, the matter, speaking of Joe Sample, in our Labor Day tournament, a lot of these people just took it for granted that they were in it. Well, Joe Sample came in and said, well, I'm going to pay my entrance. I says, Joe, the tournament's full, you know, which it was. I said, I'm sorry. Oh, boy, he got really, really hostile at that time. But eventually we were able to get him into it, but that's how that tournament was. It was first come, first served, and once it was full, it was full. And
three-day tournament.
Three-day tournament, yeah, and we had a big event up at the Holiday Inn, had Calcutta, and it was a really a big thing. The Holiday Inn, with their sponsorship, furnished the food and things like that at our Calcutta, and it was really a...
Now, what is Calcutta?
That is where you buy, it's a gambling procedure that's done in golf where you buy certain players for this because you bid on them and how much you will pay for that team, you know, to win, place, or show, you know, three places and things like that. And all of the money from the money that was raised from this would go into the Calcutta, and then the house would take a cut, which was the golf course, and we would pay some of our things that we had out of that Calcutta money, and the rest of it would go into the pot, and we'd be divided. We'd say the first place team will get 60% of the pot, the second place team will get 20% or 30% of the pot, and third place team will get the remainder of how much is in there. So actually a first place in the we'll say the championship flight could be several thousands of dollars that they would...
this is in the 70s, early 70s.
Oh, yeah, that they would receive under the table, naturally, to because they were amateurs, but it was a gambling procedure that still takes place to this day in a lot of tournaments. So, but like
That's
I
why
said...
why the NCAA was concerned, huh?
They were probably concerned over some of that, but like I said, it was all taken care of above the board. No... Nobody ever got in any trouble in any of our tournaments, but that was a procedure that was, in fact, that was a big event, the Calcutta. Everybody looked forward to that. They still have it, even at the Temple Cup. They still have it the night before the tournament, you know, where you can bid on how much you will pay for a team, you know, and a winning number, you know, whoever pays the most gets that team, and so much of the pot goes to the winners in second place and third place. So it's a neat event.
You've mentioned a few local people who've played, and we have a list here of the first
sign-ins
of the Green Face.
And there may be some on the back. I don't know for sure, but I just happen to have that out in my shop. And
Who stands out in your mind as just being really top-notch golfers that were sort of regulars there in the early days?
Probably the Still brothers were probably the best golfers that we had. That was Malcolm, who has passed away, and his brother Mike, who lives in Baton Rouge now. They were both golfers.
How do you spell that last name?
Still, S-T-I-L-L.
Okay.
Malcolm used to work with the company, in fact. He was in purchasing with Don Hendricks. They were both probably the best amateur golfers in the area. Mike and Malcolm both played in the Armed Forces golf team, so they were very good golfers. They used to play out at Oak Ridge with us and things like that. So we had, and then they moved down here when this golf course was built. But we had a lot of good golfers in the area. You know, Keith Fergus, and I see a lot of these guys even on television now that are playing on the Champions Tour, which is the seniors tour that used to play out here a lot. Robert Hoyt and some of those other guys.
Hoyt?
Robert Hoyt, H-O-Y-T, played for the University of Houston. And one neat thing about him, he was 6'8". He was a big man. And he could do a trick with a golf ball. He could hit a sand wedge and catch it, which is quite an accomplishment. He could take a full swing at a sand wedge and pop it up in the air and catch the ball before it hit the ground. So somebody needs to try that if they want to try a trick. But Robert Hoyt could do that. Like I said, I'm sure that after we're done here, I'll be able to think of a lot of names of, you know, people that, you know, are turned professional that used to play out there on a regular basis.
Yeah.
But
did you give lessons?
Yes, definitely. I gave lessons to just about everybody in this town. In fact, there's a lot of good golfers that are still around. I used to have the school used to come out there, their PE classes.
The Dalbaugh High School?
Junior high, too, and high school, and all of them would come out there, and I would give lessons to PE classes a lot of times, to boys and to girls' PE classes. So Dr. Eden's daughter, Flossie, and just a lot of them that come to my mind now that used to put Jimmy McLean, who is probably was one of the best amateur golfers in the area, Gandy Stubblefield, Horace's boy, all of those boys. I taught every the Oates boys and things like that, Bill Oates and things like that. Those I taught every one of those how to play golf because they never had a golf course until this one was built. So anybody who plays golf, particularly around this area, I probably taught at one time or another to play golf. So that's, yes, we definitely had lessons. And most of them were free. But we did give lessons on a scheduled basis. And I gave a lot of them to wives, Dr. Eden's wife, and a lot of, you know, people, Buck Ziegler and his wife, and things like that. There were a lot, Ann Temple, Ann Shands, who later was Ann Temple, Lottie Temple, and all of those ladies I gave lots and lots of lessons to, sure did. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure there's other questions that I'm omitting.
Yeah.
Just nothing really comes to mind right now. But so you came on about 68, 69.
Yeah, and then, 68. In fact, it matters, Woody Ingram and I came to town at the same time. He came from Center and I came from Lufkin. And we became very good friends. And he used to play just all the time out there.
And then I think you left in the fall of 78.
Yes, I did. I went to work for Champion in Corrigan.
Okay.
I sure did.
And I think...
I had an insurance agency over here, too. I had Dibal Insurance Agency that I had purchased from Peggy Burt, who was Felton Burt's wife, and Carla Elliott, who was Joe Elliott's wife. And so I was in the insurance business for a while. And
While you were...
After
golfing.
I got one out in between.
In between, okay.
Employment. Not while I was golfing. No, that was all I had. So don't even go there.
All right. Can you comment a little bit about that? I know the newspaper ran a little article on you and, you know, commented that you were the first and only golf pro the course ever had. And
yeah.
I think you were just, you were quoted in the paper saying you were looking for long range career choices
right.
and things like that.
I just, you know, in 1975 here in Dibal, I had, I was president of the Rotary Club, I was president of the school board, and I was president of the Boosters Club, all in 1 year. So I always had my basket full of things that I was doing, you know, with Dibal, because Dibal has always, is my home, has always been my home, always will be my home. And I was very, very active in all of Dibal, everything that they did and things like that. So, I, you know, have always stayed close to home. I hadn't gone anywhere, but, I tried several different things. I used to own the Western Auto Store, and, I bought it from Arlie Connor, and I, like I said, had an insurance agency. I'd worked for Champion until they sold out, and then I came to work for Temple. I was at the particle board plant over here in Dibal for 15 years, and that's where I retired from Temple. And even to this day, I still have a little janitorial service in Lufkin, and so I stay busy.
Well, let's move then. You mentioned some of the civic work you've done, the Booster Club, the Rotary Club,
and
the school board.
Yes.
Anything you want to share about, say, for instance, the school board? What was going on in those years?
Well, you know, in the 70s, I'm trying to think of who. We went through a couple of superintendents at that time. Don Robbins, I believe, was one of our superintendents. And at that time was when they were first requiring school board members to be trained by the state and certified to be a school board member. Even after you were elected, you had to go to several schools to, and it started at that time, we had to go to several schools on being school board members. So, and a lot of things that people, you know, a lot of members of city councils and school boards forget that they are actually, the only time they're school board members is when you're at a school board meeting. Other than that, you're just a private citizen, and you know, you don't have any authority other than that. And it's the same with a council member or anything else. People would always come to me and say, well, I want this, I want, you know, and you as an individual member of a board have no authority to act on anything other than to make a note of it and bring it up at the school board meeting and let the school board or the city council decide on what needs to be done. So a lot of times that's hard for people that are on school boards and city councils to remember that they are just members of that board at that particular night or that particular time, and that's where the authority ends. You have a vote like everybody else on that board, but that's about it. So I was active in that, and like I said, and as a Booster Club president, you're also involved with a lot of things. You're involved with the Housing Authority. You're involved with a lot of other groups as a volunteer Booster Club representative, and you have to do with the distribution of the funds that were raised by the Booster Club at Dibal Day and things like that. Of course, all these things are evolving now where it's not quite the activities that they were back at that time, and there's not quite the involvement, because the Boosters Club to me was probably the most enjoyable time I had. We used to meet at the Pine Bowl, had a meeting room back there where we would meet. So that'll tell you some size of the booster club, the active booster club, because that room wasn't very big, and there were maybe, you know, in attendance, maybe 20 people or so, you know, all crammed into that room. And we used to have a lot of fun at Dowball Day at that time. A lot of shenanigans were pulled that probably now would get you a little misdemeanor charge or something. They were borderline on being legitimate, and it was I remember Joe Denman taking a chance on a colored television, and he won it, in fact, and they brought it in, and they had an old television, council television, all painted different colors, and presented it to Mr. Denman as a colored television. And I can remember one particular prank that I pulled while I was president was that we sold chances on a 38 special. And I had Mr. Connor gave me a pistol to hold out, you know, a 38 pistol. And I said, we're taking chances on a 38 special. Well, that 38 special turned out to be a bra and a 38D that I think Joe Sample or somebody won, and we gave it to him. And that was his 38 special. But we did a lot of things like that, and all in good, you know, in good-natured fun. So, and all the money went back to the booster club. Nobody profited from it. But and the Rotary Club. I was, in fact, the matter is, I don't know if many people know it, but we used to even have an Optimist Club here in Dowball. I was a charter member of the Optimist Club, and it didn't last long in Dowball. And I was also a charter member of the Dowball Rotary Club. So I was always quite active in civic events. I was always, and I still, my interest lies in the activities that take place within Dowball.
Right.
That's probably why I'm here.
Let's going back to the golf course, and you know, we mentioned a lot of these other civic groups,
yeah,
and organizations, and you know, I guess the question stemming from funding, and the golf course finances. How was the golf course funded?
Through the city, but I think that the city was subsidized through the Temple Foundation at that time, and that's where their funds came from. As far as the city giving me a budget and saying, all right, this is how much money you have to work with, at that particular time there was no such thing as that. Mr. Temple would, you know, tell me what he wanted me to get, and I would get it, or I would present to him or Mr. Stubblefield what we needed. And I really wasn't that actively involved in obtaining the funds. I told them what we needed and why we needed it and justified it. And if they felt it was justified, there was a real...
So you didn't submit an annual budget or anything?
No, not per se. You know, back then, times have changed certainly, but there was a trust issue involved. They trusted me with that position to do the right thing. And I was never questioned on it or anything like that. And so I know that we can't do that anymore, but back then there was the element of trust was heavily involved in all of our decisions on things that we needed and things like that. They trusted me that I was submitting to them something that we needed and would use, and there were really no questions asked. All they asked for was justification on why we needed this particular piece of equipment and things like that and what it would do. And that was one thing, like I said, on riding greens mowers and sand trap raking machines and things like that. If I could justify the need for them and what they would do, what would be the benefits of it and what was the cost and things like that, we generally ended up with it. And I generally didn't submit something that I could not justify
right,
as being needed out there at the golf course.
Now on the income side, greens fees.
Okay,
and
these
like
sheets
that,
here, that's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned that because that, again, comes in with the trust business. What we would do every day, I would take to the city the money that I'd gotten the day before from green fees, and it was based on people that signed in, how much the green fee was at that time, a dollar or two or three or whatever it was. I know it was a lot less than it is now, because I can remember that our carts used to be $3.50 for an electric cart, and now it's considerably higher. But that was another thing. I owned all of the golf carts.
Personally.
So that was part of my income. You know, that's why I say I couldn't make it on $400 or $600 a month. I think they eventually raised my salary to $600 a month, but I had all of the I bought all of the range balls, I bought the carts, I did all those things. So that subsidized that meager salary that they were giving me to where I could survive.
Now, as far as setting the greens fees and
that was done by the Parks Board.
The Parks Board did.
Park Board did all of that.
Did you have any input?
Sure, I did.
Okay.
Yeah. I met with the Parks Board. You know, whenever there was a meeting, I was the center of attention.
What? You know what process you went through? Did you look at other nine-hole courses across the state?
I don't think any of that was based on at that, of course, like I said, I don't believe at that time that finances were a problem because of the Temple Foundation. I think with their subsidy, the green fees were not a part of it. I mean, we didn't even know how many players to base it on, you know, as far as now it's all computerized and things like that. They know how many played and blah, 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 all of this. We never knew that.
Right.
The green fees were never based on that. I think the green fees, individual yearly green fee used to be $75 for a year.
For a whole year.
Now, we wanted people to play. It was a public course. We wanted them to come out and play. And at that time, like I say, finances were not a problem because of the Temple Foundation. So that it was not a consideration on our fees at all was whether we were going to make enough revenue to pay for what we had, because everything we had was furnished by the foundation anyway. And so it had nothing to do with the green fees or cart, you know, or any of that stuff. So that was never a consideration. I never once looked around at other golf courses, what they were charging or anything like that. We tried to keep it as reasonable as we could, where there would be a fee for them to play. But you know, we allowed high school kids and stuff like that to play. We didn't charge them a thing. You know, we just wanted them to be a part of it. It was a part of die ball, and if they couldn't afford to play, they didn't have to pay. You know, I furnished just jillions of kids golf clubs and things like that to use to play the game and learn the game, and that are still playing today and probably wouldn't have played if that equipment hadn't been furnished to them. So,
I know that year or two that I played was about 89 or 90, and I know even then, you know, the golf course in Nacogdoches, the one in Livingston, the city course in Livingston. You know, and die ball was always, the nine hole was the best and the cheapest.
Yeah.
And there was a deal at the time, I think it was during the weekdays after
hours,
time, 4 o'clock.
Yeah, right. At an evening.
You know, during the summer, you could easily, you know, walk. You could easily get 18, maybe 27.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And I don't remember what it was, but it was $10 or less.
Yeah, right.
And for 18 or 27 holes. And,
like
sure
I say, our
more now, but
I forget what our green fee was, but it wasn't much. I do know that our cart rentals were $350 and for an electric cart. So you can tell I wasn't making much on them.
It says here, greens fees will be $2 on weekdays and $2.50 on weekends.
Yep.
That was when it opened.
Isn't that something?
Students can play for $1.50 during the week and at the regular rate of $2.50 on weekends. That was from
that was just trying
September 3rd of 70.
Yeah, trying to. The reason that they had to pay a regular fee on the weekends is because of the amount of play we had. You know,
even in 89 and 90, you know, you had to have four and you had to have reservations.
Yes, that's correct.
You couldn't just show up.
It got to be that to that point, which we really loved because of the fact we had tee times. We had a starter out there on the tee box to start them, you know, that they went in their assigned time and things like that. So all those things were important at that time.
There's a photograph of you from 69.
Golly. Isn't that's my old white pickup truck.
He's looking
at my old Chevrolet pickup truck.
A news clipping from 69.
Yeah. I'll tell you what we did in 1976. I was on the Bicentennial Committee representing Diboll. In Lufkin had a Bicentennial Committee. We painted all of our dome top posts around our parking lot red, white, and blue. And a gate we had painted red, white, and blue where you would come in. And so we were quite active in that. In fact, I've got a lot of memorabilia from the Bicentennial year. And it was things like that that we did that was kind of neat. And like I said, I was very active with that.
There's Mr. Demerit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the picture. And that's him right there. Sure is.
I think that's the one we ran in the Pine Bowl with you and Mr. Temple and Demerit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they were in the cart and they had you walking around.
They had me walking. That's correct.
With
exactly.
The can of spray paint.
Yep. Yeah. It was one of those spray paints that it was on kind of a long handle type of a deal. Golly. And there's old Woody Ingram's article in the paper too. Yeah, outdoors with Woody. Yeah.
Said that in this 1970 article here that the course was located in East Diboll as part of the new $350,000 city park.
Yeah.
That
met with the state. You see, we had state funding that was involved in that too. We had to have a sign posted out there that it was a part of that project from the state.
Parks and Wildlife Department.
Yeah, we had that big sign up on the pro shop, you know, that told all the entities that were involved in building that golf course.
The paper even mentioned the U.S. Department of Interior.
Yeah, yeah. So, like I say,
did you have to work directly with them, or
no,
was that
nothing.
Course
that was all
took care of all that?
I never even had anything to do with any of that. Okay. I didn't have any contact with them. Was never questioned by them or talked to them. Or anybody like
that. So the Parks Board handled
that.
That
was all that. That sure was. But it was quite neat. And like I said, it was very unique. You know, you have to remember how unique that was that we got all this. And if it wasn't for, you know, Mr. Temple and his cronies, we wouldn't have any of this stuff.
Right.
You know, when we think of all the things that Mr. Temple did for the whole area, this was one of the major things that he did for Diboll. Was that park. I used to go over there to the park because I was in charge of I was a park superintendent too and golf pro and all of the above. But
and all of the below.
Yeah, that's for sure. But it was quite a time, quite an experience for sure.
Well, I think we pretty much covered all that I had written down.
Well, that's
anything,
good.
Anything else you can?
No,
think of
I was my. You know, it was just probably the most memorable time of my life was working at the golf course and with the city and with the people. Mr. Temple and Buddy and I became quite close at that time, and we both stayed in quite a bit of mischief with Mr. Temple.
did he play quite a bit? Buddy?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah. Darn right. A lot of times when he was probably supposed to be working. Of course, he was a state representative, too, and things like that. So on Railroad Commission and things
Did he bring people into play?
He always brought lots of people.
Awesome.
All of them did. Mr. Temple did. You know, they always brought a lot of people into play. Sure did. And
any other professionals that came through, like Demerit? I guess he was a golf champ for a while?
We also have to remember that shortly, the golf course was still open when Crown Colony was developed at that time, too. I was approached about that position up there, Mr. Stubblefield, shortly after I had left the golf course in 78 and 79, wanted to talk to me about Crown Colony, and I just told him I had just about all the golf I could handle over those last 10 years, and I really wasn't interested anything up there, but I did make lots of trips up there with Mr. Temple and Mr. Stubblefield to look at the dirt work that was being done and look at the layout and things like that when they were building Crown Colony.
Kind of a consultant or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Because I think, in talking with Mr. Temple, you know, he credits Mr. Stubblefield, you know, with that that whole project, Crown Colony.
Yeah.
So he was, I guess, the point man on
He was. On Sabine Investment handled all of that up there. They sure did. Yeah. But he had a lot of, Mr. Stubblefield had a lot of projects going. Of course, like I say, things have all changed over the years, but at that particular time, Sabine was a pretty big part of Temple.
Now, I know the newspapers commented at the time the dime ball course was going in, you know, mentioned it was a nine-hole course. And,
yeah.
You know, there was always a little mention that, you know, one day it'll
be 18. Yeah. Well, it was originally laid out as an 18-hole course.
Well, that's what I was meaning earlier when I was asking.
No, it was definitely laid out. Yeah, I'll find them. Well, they showed the whole 18.
They do show the whole 18.
Yeah.
Do you recall if what they showed then is what is
I don't remember all of that. I think it's been modified because of the fact, like I said, there was going to be a quarter horse track and thing. You know, one thing I will mention though that was that I didn't mention that we learned on from building this course is after we built the course, we didn't have any water for our irrigation system. So Topaz Oil Company, which was a subsidiary of Temple and directly Lowellwood and Dub Fitzgerald were the geologists that headed up the Topaz Oil at that time, we went all over the area drilling test holes and things like that to find adequate water. We never did find any real adequate water supply. We used, we went, 1,000-foot well is the one that was originally used, and we had Barry Drilling Company out of Corrigan who used to have a motel down there and, also did water well work and things like that, but they drilled that first hole was Barry Drilling Company out of Corrigan that drew this first hole that was we found 100 feet of sand, water sand, at 1,000 feet, and it still wasn't enough. We had to choke back the well to where we could keep pumping to fill up the pond. We didn't have any thing there. When we were drilling, that brings a funny story to mind. When we were first drilling that well, Becca, it's in you can see it on the old, let's see, what's that par 3 hole now? That must be 17. Right behind the 17 green, you can see the original well is sitting back there now. It's all been capped and things like that since that time, but that's where the original water. Well, anyway, while we were drilling that well, Benny Brown and Bert Lindsay both rode dirt bikes, and I always had a fit with them. But anyway, they came out there while we were drilling that hole, that well, that 1,000-foot well. They came out, and how y'all doing and stuff like that. Well, anyway, the night before we had a water line break back on what was the old number 7 par 3 hole. It's the number 14 now. Par 3 hole, there's a little pond off to the left down there. But anyway, they used to ride their bikes in and out of the excavations for our ponds and things like that.
Motorcycles.
Yeah, motorcycles, yeah. Yeah, dirt bikes, yeah. They were, yeah, motorcycles is what they were. Anyway, we had a water line break, and it filled that pond over there, which is now the number 7 hole. Well, Benny Brown takes off on his bike. I knew just exactly where he was headed, over to that excavation that they used to ride through. Well, in a little while, he came back, drenched, covered with mud, dragging his motorbike. He called me a lot of nice names, and I said, "Dadgummit, Benny, I forgot to tell you about that thing being filled up with water," because they would always go up and jump over that water. So he found out there was water in it and mud and all the things. It probably wasn't very deep at that time. It was probably only a few feet deep with water because there wasn't enough water to produce to do much damage. But That was one of the things that took place. But Lowellwood and Dub Fitzgerald were instrumental. In fact, the matter is, a lot of our test holes are now, in fact, one of them I know is a city well that they use. It was at the end of what was the old airstrip back over there now behind ATCO, and that we had drilled a lot of test holes in that area. And like I said, I think now the city even utilizes some of that, but we learned long before to find water first before you build a golf course, because we did not have a water supply, adequate water supply. We didn't realize how precious water was. And like I say, Lowellwood and Dub Fitzgerald both had harped on that for years about our water in East Texas being a scarce commodity, good water, and it certainly was. But we probably spent months drilling test holes and looking for adequate water supply. And in fact, the matter was, even at that time, we talked about piping water from the Natchez up here to have an adequate water supply. That's how desperate we were to find water to water the golf course. So a lot of things like that you never think about until like now when we're in conversation. But I do remember that we traveled all over this area drilling test holes. We drilled a test hole behind what is now the number 15 tee box out there. Had a test hole drilled out there. We drilled a lot of test holes around, probably 6-10 test holes around this area looking for water that we
just
could
solely
get
for water for
strictly
the
for the golf course.
Strictly for the golf course.
Yeah, that's something that people don't talk much about, but there was scarce supply of adequate water for the golf course. In fact, like I said, even on our 9-hole golf course, we had a real water problem. Like I said, we had that 1,000-foot well with 100 foot of water producing sand, but it still wasn't enough to adequately water the golf course.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Palsy, I sure appreciate
it. Well, I appreciate you taking the time, and I've got in my car some of those certificates I'm going to bring in and give to you.
Okay.
From the PGA.
Well, I'll go ahead and stop the recorder.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.